Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011. Lecture 5, delivered on September 7, 2011. The title of this lecture is Monetary Policy.
Today, monetary policy. The relationship between monetary policy and finance is rather important, because monetary policy drives not just the economy in the short and intermediate run, perhaps even in the long run, but it also drives interest rates. Interest rates drive business. Let me give you an example of how important interest rates are. It seems like a stupid example, but it really does hit to the heart of what we do in this course. Suppose that you have three projects that are being considered by a company. Project, and for lack of any creativity whatsoever, Project A has a projected return on investment of 15%. Project B has an expected return on investment of 10%. And Project C has an expected return on investment of 5%. Now, understand that means nothing without context. Suppose that I can get capital for projects. I can get whatever capital I need at a marginal cost of capital of, let's say, in scenario one, I can get capital at a marginal cost of that capital, in other words, of the cost of the next dollar of capital for the project, of 3%. Now, talk to me. Will I take on Project A if I get 15% from it and the cost of the capital to finance a project is 3%? Will I take five? Yes, you are going to be a finance PhD. It's not as hard. How about Project B? Will I take on Project B? Oh, sure. I mean, it returns 10% and it costs 3% to finance it. Absolutely. And Project C, madam, will you take it? Why not? It gives you 5%. Money costs you only 3%. So what's your gain? 2%, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah, you thought I was going to give you a trick question. No, this is not trick. It's obvious. You will take on all of these projects because you are going to get more from every one of them than it costs you to finance them. Now let's go to scenario two. Now in scenario two, the interest rate environment has risen such that the marginal cost of capital is 7%. Now, again, I'll take on Project A. 15% for money that costs me 7%? Yeah, that's a good idea. As a matter of fact, I'll take on Project B because I get 10% and it costs me only 7%. But Project C is no longer going to provide me with any good idea whatsoever because it costs me 7% and I'm expecting a return of only 5%. No. Project C is gone. So notice as the interest rate environment rises, not just that you lose an investment, you'll reject an investment, but more importantly, you see how simple the answer why is. As the interest rate environment rises, investment is cut off. It begins to truncate. There's something else going on here too, but I'll wait until after scenario three. Suppose scenario three is such that the interest rate environment has risen to 12%. Well, I'm sure I'm going to take on Project A, yeah. Because it's 15%, money costs 12%, yeah, I'll handle it, I'll do it. But Project B is now in the wastebasket. I get 10%, but it would cost me 12% for the capital for it. I'm not going to do that. I'm not. And obviously, Project C is not going to happen either. So as the interest rate environment rises more, even more business investment goes away. What does that mean in practical terms? The economy slows down. For you, it means it's harder for you to find a job. You end up saying, may I help you, McPlease? Or something like that. You see what's happening. As interest rates rise, the economy slows down. Jobs are therefore no longer being formed by the formation of new projects. Capital is not being created because the investments that create the projects that create new capital is not being created. So, but there's a darker story going on here. There's something else that's going on under the surface. I mentioned this early in the course, but I want to go back to it. One of the first principles of finance is that the greater the risk that you bear, the greater the return you must expect. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. You will not bear risk for nothing. And markets, capital markets, are so efficient that if they even smell risk, they will expect more for it. If I ask you to jump out that window just for shits and giggles, you're going to say, you have your own shits and giggles, professor. If I say at the bottom of that jump is a $2,000 pile of money, well, there's an expectation of return. Of course, there's also the possibility that you'll die, but what the hell? We all die someday. If I said that, there is this expected return. You don't bear risk unless you expect something out of it. In finance, that expectation is money, okay? Now, call me a greedy son of a bitch, but that's what we do. You know, the return, like, have you ever seen Fail Blog or one of those places where kids try to get themselves killed doing stupid things? Now, you say, well, they're not getting any money, they're taking risks. Well, that's because they're stupid. But no, there's actually more to it than that. Rationally speaking, they are gaining credibility. They are, something is in it for them. You don't take risk for no reason whatsoever. You bear risk because you expect a gain from it. You drive at a speed above the speed limit, and most of you do. I've seen you drive like blind trout. You're dangerous. But anyway, you drive above the speed limit, not for no reason. You're bearing the risk of getting caught by the man. So why are you doing it? Because you get someplace faster. Because you get the thrill of watching the stars go by you with streaks, like in the Star Trek movies. You understand that the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Risk and expected return. Not return. We don't know what the future, it's expected. Where there's no guarantees in the future. Look at what's happening there as those projects are being systematically rejected in the higher and higher interest rate environments. Look where the company is heading with its projects. Is it heading towards the lower return projects or is it heading towards the higher return projects? What do you see? As interest rates rise, is the company heading towards the lower risk projects or the higher risk projects? You see it? It's heading toward the higher ones. You do see that, right? Look at it. You see how that, as the interest rates went from 3% to 7% to 12%, the company's average risk of its projects went from the average of 15, 10, and 5 to the average of 15 and 10 to the average of 15. This company, as the interest rate environment rises, this company is being flogged toward higher risk, long bomb, Hail Mary projects. That's one of the darker sides of a rising interest rate environment, is that not only do you lose business investment, jobs, the whole nine yards, you also see companies having to do things that they otherwise probably wouldn't do. Their portfolio of projects begins to tilt toward greater risk because they have to tilt toward greater expected return. Essentially, when you're down to your last few bucks, that's when you buy the lottery ticket. Essentially, when you're down to your last $100, you're more likely to throw a significant amount at a risky bet. It's just simply that you're being driven to do that. So that's one of the other dangers of a rising interest rate environment. Not only does it depress economic activity, but it also tends to have an effect of pushing companies to go only for the riskier projects. You see, there's nothing wrong with a company doing risky things. That's how we get new ideas started. That's how we really push forward. But at the same time, there is nothing inherently evil about a low-risk project. As a matter of fact, companies that are all about just high-risk, 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 we have a name for them. Usually, they're called bankruptcies. Companies that are more into, well, we do a lot of safe projects, but here we push one or two more risky projects. They're more likely to be long-term survivors than are the companies that just attack high-risk projects. So this company, which would actually be more stable in a lower interest rate environment, becomes more unstable, riskier in a high, just in terms of its survivability in the high interest rate environment. That's one of the problems with recessions, is that they tend to be self-feeding, because companies, the ones that survive into the depths of the recession, tend to take on riskier projects to keep themselves going. And then that makes them more likely and more susceptible to a bankruptcy. And therefore, that means that we have more companies in the deeper part of the recession suddenly going under. It's like a second wave. And a lot of analysts or untrained people say, well, boy, this recession just suddenly got worse. Why was that? Well, it was because that's one of the things that happens, that dark second wave where companies that would have survived, they move towards riskier projects, and then within a few months, within a few quarters, a couple of years, suddenly they're having problems and they will be out of business soon enough. What does this mean in real terms? There are some companies out there that are long-term survivors that are not going to be here within the next year. Does anyone want to know what some of those companies might be? Do you have any ideas? I am cautious about saying them on a podcast, but there are quite a few rumors about some of them. One of the examples that is being predicted that will fold, I'm not sure, but it's got an awful lot of bad mojo around it right now, and the markets are getting real dim on it.
Sears.
Can you imagine a company that has survived that long suddenly disappearing from the American landscape? It survived into the recession. It survived deep into the recession. It has survived into what amounts to a recovery in modern economies, and now it's going to go away. Other companies that will be gone, names you might recognize.
Sony Ericsson.
I don't want anyone suing my ass for pushing them over the edge. What else is in financial trouble right now?
Sony itself.
What else is in trouble right now? Probably
Nokia.
Don't try to short them, okay? Because the markets already know it's happening. Look at the stock prices. Look at the short interest out there on these companies. I mean, by the time you hear about it, and we'll talk a lot about this later in this course, by the time you hear about it, it's too late to make any money off it. Even if you are very astute, you can't beat efficient markets, especially anymore with these crazy-ass high-frequency trading programs and all that. Let's get down to it. What drives interest rates up and down? In the short run and in the intermediate run, the driver of the interest rates is the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States. Now, as I had told you, the Federal Reserve has three different tasks that it carries out. It regulates and supervises the banking system. That's one of its three. It regulates and supervises the banking system. One of its three jobs. At the level of the Board of Governors, the regulation happens. In other words, the rules that are based upon the laws and upon current economic circumstances. And then those rules are passed to these district banks, which then supervise the member banks in their respective districts. In other words, they go in, they audit, they promulgate the rules from the governors down to the banks saying, well, okay, member banks in our region, this is what the governors have said on this matter for now. Okay, so the Board of Governors regulates and the district banks, the 12 district banks, supervise the administration of those regulations within their respective districts. That's the first role of the Fed. The second role is to be a bank for banks. In other words, to be a provider of banking services for banks. They compete directly and openly against commercial private banks that do the same thing, offer banking services for banks. Banks can choose to use the Fed for their bank, or banks can choose to use one of the private commercial banks out there that does this kind of thing. In other words, the banks in the United States have a public option that has been around for decades. It has not destroyed commercial banking. It has, in fact, fostered competition, and it has actually strengthened the commercial banking system by making commercial banks so that they can't rip off banks with fees and charges. And it also provides new technology all the time, so all of the banks are really efficient with the latest and greatest stuff that's out there. So next time you hear someone bitch about public option in something like health insurance, well, that's going to destroy private health insurance. Bullshit. It's been done for years for banks. Banks can go to the government through the Federal Reserve for their banking services, or they can go to a private commercial bank. I think I already told you on this. In the St. Louis, and I checked the numbers again, in the St. Louis region, about 65% of the banks use the Fed, 35% use some private commercial bank for their banking services. And it's depends, actually. I tried to look into the details of what banks favor using the Fed and what banks favor using a private commercial service, and I really didn't see anything that gave me an indication of what the decision was. The fees are about the same. There's not much difference in fees. I think a lot of banks just like the idea of using a government resource, but that doesn't mean all banks want to, and it doesn't mean all banks do. Third role of the Fed is to conduct monetary policy. This is the one I'm talking about today. To conduct monetary policy. Now, the Fed has three ways to do this. In order of their usage, from the least used to the most used, the first way the Fed can control the money supply and conduct monetary policy is through the required reserve ratio, and I showed you how that worked today. As the Fed lowers the required reserve ratio, the money multiplier increases, which accelerates, essentially, the creation of money through the banking system. I showed you that in the last lecture. The second way the Fed does it is through the discount rate. The Fed sets a rate at which it will lend money to banks. It is a low rate. Right now it is so low, it is in the range of stupid. It is so low. Banks can go to the Fed and almost get free money. The idea was that if we do this, the banks are going to get that money, and then, of course, they're going to lend it to businesses, lend it to consumers, and the economy will just boom. The problem is, and this was highlighted in an article Bloomberg published in Bloomberg's Business Week, explained the banks took the money. They've been taking all this almost free money. They're not doing anything with it. They're sitting on their fat asses with it, investing it in things that don't create jobs, don't create new opportunities for our businesses. The banks have not been lending it out. It was called the credit crunch. The banks allegedly were afraid to lend to businesses, afraid to lend to consumers because of high default rates and all that. There was more to it than that. That's a simplistic explanation, and I'll go just that far. The reasons were more complicated and less generous in terms of why the banks were doing it, but it was very frustrating. The Fed pouring money, essentially, here's money, banks. Please take it, lend it. Lend it to businesses so they can grow, get back on their feet. Lend it to consumers so they'll start buying durable goods so that that'll get these manufacturers going again, get jobs started. The banks were doing it. And after a while, it's like, you know what? Supposedly, the banks are easing the pockets now. But the real question is, you know, I don't know. It's a difficult. I don't want to frame this and sound like some kind of raging liberal here, but you know, if you aren't going to use that money and you just sat on it and you made money off it and you didn't help us build the economy back up, well, you know what? We need to tax your ass because you took that money, you made money on it, and we don't like you to think that we're that stupid that we're going to give you money for nothing. Unfortunately, that's exactly what we did. But the discount rate used to be something that was not used too much. Banks did not go up to the discount window. Even though the rate was lower in the discount rate, the rate itself was actually more symbolic because banks didn't use the discount window. They preferred to go to other banks in what is called the federal funds market. The federal funds market to borrow money. And the rate they would borrow in the federal funds market would be the federal funds rate, which is a free market rate. It's a rate set by supply and demand, and we'll get into that in just a minute here. That's a rate set by supply and demand. And it's a higher rate than the discount rate. And the reason historically was you just didn't want to go to the Fed. You just didn't want to sort of like stir up trouble, or you didn't want to trigger the Fed to want to know why you needed all this money. So you would prefer to go to the federal funds market. Now let me explain this, and this is a little bit simplistic, but it's actually fairly accurate as far as I want to go without giving myself a headache. That is a gigantic pool, that rectangle I've drawn there. That is a gigantic pool. Now, that gigantic pool is filled with money. It's filled with money. Now, some of you are saying, but I want it to be filled with champagne and all that. Trust me, sitting in a pool of money is much more fun. You see, that money in that pool is essentially, in a conceptual way, all of the money the banks have, liquid cash money, in the United States. That's the pool. It is a giant reservoir of all the money depositors deposit that the banks have from other resources. It is in that pool right there. And that's actually, it exists out there. I can't say, well, there's the pool over there. But this is this enormous, almost like an ocean of money that is called the federal funds market. Now, in order for it to be a market, there has to be a supply and there has to be a demand. But these are the federal funds. Every bank is put, well, I shouldn't say every bank, almost all banks. Banks, I'll just say banks, put their money in there. That's their place for it. That's their mattress. And then banks can actually tap out of that. For example, you wanted to borrow money for a car. Well, it would somehow the money would come from that pool somehow, usually. A business wants to borrow money from a bank to get a project going. It would come from that. A bank that wants to borrow money to meet a reserve or something, that would be, if it went to the federal funds market, that's where the money would come from. The rate that is in this market, as I said, the federal funds rate is in lendable funds is the quantity axis. The Fed funds rate is the vertical axis. There's a demand for funds in this market, and then there is a supply of funds in this market, and those two come together to form an equilibrium federal funds rate on a given day. Now that, in real economics, you know, in an early course we show, well, here's a supply curve, here's a demand curve, here's the price. Realistically, these are ebbing and flowing. The supply and the demand are more like fuzzy shadows that kind of move back and forth from day to day, from hour to hour, especially in these high-powered markets like this. But there is a federal funds rate. At the end of every day, the Fed funds rate, you can see it. You can, okay, the federal funds rate is now sitting at 3.2%. That would be the rate at which a bank could borrow from the federal funds market to meet some need that it has. It would be higher than the discount rate, but many banks would, of course, as I had explained before, at least historically, they would go to the federal funds market. Now, if you borrow money, you're not going to get it at the federal funds rate, but make no mistake about it, that federal funds rate is going to be like a base, so that if you get a loan, if the federal funds rate is 3%, then you might get a loan at 10%. If the Fed funds rate goes up to 5%, your loan would go up to 12%. So in other words, real interest rates that drive your that drive your consumption decisions, that form the basis for investment decisions by businesses, there it is right there. We like to talk about how the Treasury bill rate drives all interest rates, to some extent. We talk about this discount rate right here. Understand this. The Federal Reserve sets the discount rate. And I'm going to ask you this. I swear to you. I promise you. The Federal Reserve sets the discount rate because it's the Federal Reserve's discount window. It can charge what it wants. The Federal Reserve cannot set the federal funds rate. So many times you hear these supposed experts saying the Federal Reserve set the federal funds rate. No, it can't. It will set a target for it. And then it conducts a certain type of operation to try to move the federal funds rate toward the target. But it cannot set that federal funds rate because that federal funds rate is driven by supply and demand dynamics. So what that means is that if the Federal Reserve wants to move the federal funds rate, it can't just say, thou shalt be. It must actually manipulate the supply and demand curves to get the federal funds rate to move towards its target. And that's where we go now. The third tool of monetary policy is the one that happens every day, day in, day out, to the tune of billions and billions of dollars. What is amazing is how extraordinary this market is, how much impact it has on the economy, how much impact it has on business and human life. And yet almost no one in this country knows about it, except for students in business and in economics who are in good programs where they teach this. You walk up to the average person on the street and say, what's an open market operation? What's the federal funds rate? Well, you might get some people know that. Well, how is the federal funds rate moved around by the Federal Reserve? I don't know. Do you know how much money is involved? What? I don't know. You would be surprised how extraordinary this market is, how powerfully effective and effective it is, and yet almost no one knows about it, except for people like you. Thank God you have me for your professor. Open market operations. Yeah. What?
The interest rate that the Fed pays banks on their required reserves. They could raise that giving banks incentive to go and keep more reserves or by decreasing.
The question is, what is that rate? What's the required reserve? Remember what I told you in the last lecture? What's the required reserve ratio on the first tranche of money in banks in the United States?
Nothing for the first.
Zero. Effectively, there is no required reserve ratio. Let me ask you this. As a matter of fact, I want to bring that up. What is 1 divided by 0? It's undefined. In other words, it's infinity, okay? So what would that mean that the money multiplier theoretically should be if there is no required reserve ratio? It should be, the money multiplier should be infinite. So any amount of money going in the system should suddenly, almost instantaneously, become an infinity of money. Well, obviously, that's not happening. I don't see money flying around in the air. So apparently, the simple required reserve ratio isn't the right one. There's a cash balances in it. But more importantly, that almost has become a moot thing now, that whole required reserve ratio. It's to the point where there's almost nothing that it has no meaning whatsoever in practical terms. But the payment on that required reserve ratio, well, if there was one, then maybe we could talk about it, but there isn't. But it's a good point. But the open market operation, they are carried out by the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. The Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. Now this is quite an organization. It has 12 members. Now, the 7 governors are permanent members. There is one permanent district bank president. That is the president of the Empire Bank, the New York Bank. There's a reason why he is always going to be a permanent member. And then there are 4 other district bank presidents that serve on rotating 2-year terms. And so you have a turnover. Now, this is watched actually fairly closely because the different district bank presidents, they have different philosophies. They're all... Historically, they were all very, very bright. Banking, economics, finance, the whole 9 yards. They're not, I don't have as much confidence as I once did. But you watch who's on there. For example, you might see one of the bank presidents had done his 2 years. He was really the kind of guy who said, don't worry about inflation. We've got to get this economy going again. And then replacing him is an inflation hawk, one of the bank presidents who has made a lot of public statements about, we can't just keep shoveling money. We are going to have an inflation if we don't stop it. So we watch that to see how that can move policy. Know this, that over the history of the Federal Reserve, there have been power centers. Oftentimes the chairman will be very influential, and he will do whatever he can to make sure that his position is what comes out of FOMC meetings. Story was that Alan Greenspan was very much that way. Especially in his later years, he turned into almost a dictator, and there was no tolerance for reasonable dissent from his rabid. By the end of his term, he was just seethingly, rabidly hating the success that had happened in the 1990s. And to the extent that single-handedly, even though there were Fed people who said, why are you doing this? He raised the discount rate 6 consecutive times. There was not any evidence of an inflation. See, the discount rate is sort of like a signal. This is what the Fed thinks. Raise the discount rate, that's a signal that the Fed's worried about inflation. Lower the discount rate, the Fed is signaling that it's more worried about recession. Greenspan went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There had never been that many increases in the discount rate, ever. And yet Greenspan was just obsessed with trying to kill this massively, rapidly growing economy that didn't have any inflation in it. You'll see in a minute why he was doing that. And I'll talk about it, and I'll also assign you an article. Okay. The FOMC meets 8 times a year. It can meet more than that. And they make policy decisions about money. Are we going to expand the money supply? Are we going to contract the money supply? Or are we going to hold a steady course with the money supply? Now, the FOMC's meeting itself, some parts are kind of open, but the votes themselves, only the 12 vote, and the meeting at that point is closed. We know about what they voted a while later, but not right away, because we don't want arbitragers playing games trying to jump in front of the Fed's activities. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, the FOMC, makes a vote. Let's say that they vote to pursue an expansionary monetary policy. They want to expand the money supply through open market operations. Here's how they do it. And there are 2 different separate effects from what they're doing, but they work in coordination with each other. Now, the FOMC makes its vote. Now, remember that the Empire Bank president is sitting there. He is one of the voters. Once the vote is taken, okay, we're going to expand the money supply. The Empire Bank president communicates that to the Empire Bank, because at the Empire Bank is the center of a massive operation called the Domestic Trading Desk, the DTD, the Domestic Trading Desk. And when I say desk, I'm not talking about something you buy at Walmart, like a souder desk. A desk is this big operation. And the manager at the desk gets the word, expand the money supply. So the desk manager sends the word, and I'm doing this a little simplistically here, to this whole massive ocean of traders who are the Fed desk traders. They are Fed employees, and if you're ever interested in a job that pays well, you get to live in New York City and you get to play with millions and billions of dollars. This is a job. Okay, let me focus on one of these desk players. Now, a desk player will have a group of banks that are his or hers. Now, the desk trader, he will have a portfolio of dollars and treasury bills. He can use either one he wants. He or she can use either one desired. Now, that trader is going to start handling banks, calling banks. This is a member bank in the system. Now, here's how it works, and you have to know a little bit about supply and demand and all that. Now, remember, now understand that the bank has a tier one portfolio. In other words, highly liquid assets in its first tier. Those liquid assets comprise, not surprisingly, dollars and T-bills. Both are highly liquid, but there's a difference. Dollars are coming from the federal funds reserve pool that the bank, that little bank there, these are from that pool over there. It's just a tiny little microcosm of that pool. The T-bills, and those dollars can be lent to people and businesses that want to borrow money. Those T-bills, every bit as liquid, every bit as safe, notwithstanding the idiotic asses at Standard & Poor's, they're every bit as safe as the dollars. Which doesn't say much. Well, anyway, but they are not lendable. You can't lend someone a T-bill. Try it. Go to a Wendy's and try to use a T-bill for one of those double Wendy's. Never mind. It doesn't work. You see, the bank has the T-bills. It can't lend out. It has the dollars that it can lend out. So you're a trader at the desk. You want to add money to that bank. Dollars. Because the dollars the bank could lend, you, in other words, you want to get the bank, induce the bank to give up some of its T-bills for dollars. In other words, you want to offer the bank T-bills for dollars. So I'm a trader at the desk, and I'm calling you. You're a bank president. And I'm saying, hi. You know what? I really would like to buy some of your T-bills. You see, because if I buy your T-bills, you'll send me T-bills, I'll send you money. That puts more money into your bank, puts more money into the reserve system, okay? I really want to buy some of your T-bills. And you say, okay, well, what do you want for a T-bill? And I say, I'll tell you what. I'll pay you $940 for a T-bill. Okay? Now, you being a good banker, you say, oh, I don't want that. That's kind of stupid. That's not a good price. You hang up on me. So I call you back. You know what? I was wrong. $950. How about $950? I'm sorry, click. I call you back. My bad. $970. What am I doing to the price of the T-bill? To get him to buy it. To get him to sell me his T-bills, what do I have to do to the price of the T-bill to get him to give them up for to me? I'm having to lift them up. I'm having to put them up. In economic terms, what's happening here is that if this is T-bills and this is the price of T-bills, what's happening is that my activities in the market are surging the demand for T-bills. So the price of T-bills goes from P1 to P2. Do you remember what I showed you in that last lecture? When the price of a T-bill goes up, what happens to the yield on the T-bill? You remember it? Goes down. So in other words, as I am bidding up on T-bills, that surging demand in the open market for T-bills, which is driving the price of the T-bills up, which is driving their yields down. So what's happening here is you finally say, well, geez, that's a great price for a T-bill. I'll sell. So you send me a T-bill, and I send you a dollar, or 970 of them. More money goes into the federal funds pool. At the same time, by my open market activities as a desk trader, I'm pushing T-bill prices up, which is lowering T-bill yields. In other words, I am actually lowering the cost of borrowing by the United States government, because the T-bills are from the government. So I'm driving their interest rates down so the government doesn't pay as much interest on its T-bills, on its short-term instruments. At the same time I'm doing that, look what's happening. If you've got thousands of trades happening every hour, look what's happening in the federal funds market. As banks sell their T-bills, the Fed electronically sends money in their accounts into the federal funds pool. Now look over there at that federal funds supply and demand. Tell me what's happening in the federal funds supply and demand. What's moving, demand or supply? As more of these, those dollars go in, you set it up there, what was it? Supply, good. As those dollars are electronically transferred from the traders to the bank into their accounts in the federal funds market, suddenly the supply curve is swinging outward hard. And what does that do to the federal funds rate? It drives the federal funds rate down. The Fed cannot set the federal funds rate, but it can push it down by pouring money into the federal funds market, increasing the supply, driving down the price of lendable funds, the federal funds rate. Theoretically, as that price of federal funds goes down, the Fed funds rate goes down, that should bring down rates on all kinds of loans. You saw that happening. The Fed's aggressive over the past 2.5 years, 3 years, aggressive, it's actually almost 3 years now, just pouring money into the economy. That's how they were doing it. They were pouring it in through open market operations, just flooding the federal funds market with dollars by buying up the T-bills from the banks. They were buying up the T-bills from the banks, and then that money would go into the federal funds market, drive down interest rates on federal funds, the federal funds rate down. So that's how we got these low, low interest rates on home mortgages, on cars, on all kinds of things. That was what did it. Was the Fed just simply shoving the supply of money in the federal funds market outward over and over again, day in, day out? That is what, have any of you heard the term quantitative easing? Have you heard that term? That was what they were, the QEs, there was QE1, then QE2, and now they're talking about a QE3. That's quantitative easing, easing the money supply, expanding that pool as fast as they can, trying to get the economy to wake back up. That is how an open market operation would work for an expansionary monetary policy. I want you to notice something, a couple of things here that are kind of weird, though. Here's a dark side, and I always love to tell a dark side to this story. And this one, I actually I didn't even mean to find it. I was teaching this in an economics course, and I was just ranting, and I decided I'd put up showing the Treasury bill yield, price and yield, and showing how you could actually see during a federal funds, when the traders were going crazy and selling them, how you would see the price of the T-bills going up, so the yields were going down. I was saying, see, look at how the Treasury bill on a timeline. Look here. See how the price of the T-bills is going up? That's the traders hitting the banks and just bidding up the price until the banks sell their T-bills off. I said, see, isn't that cool? And then I expanded the graph a little bit, and I looked like an idiot because suddenly I hit that. The price collapsed. And I just sort of looked at it. And I thought, what happened? Did all the traders die or something? Did a zombie apocalypse happen at the desk? And they, you know, the price just collapsed. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Why? Oh, wait. And I looked at the date on the date that the collapse happened. The date was the date of a Treasury auction. In other words, when the Treasury issues new T-bills, when the Treasury goes out there and, you know, borrows money. They do it on these auctions every couple of weeks and all that. And I thought, no, wait a minute. So, in other words, okay, work it out in my mind. So suddenly the Treasury had one of its auctions. This big supply of Treasury bills suddenly shows up at the auction table. Well, that would increase the supply. And when you increase the supply, the price of the T-bills would fall. You follow me? And I know if you don't, just listen, just follow through it a couple of times. Again, I'll say it again. The domestic traders at the trading desk had bought and bid up the price of T-bills to get the banks to sell them so the banks would take money and put it in the federal funds market. Okay, and that brings up the price of the T-bills because you've got all this extra demand for T-bills from the Fed traders, and so that drives up the price, yields go down. Okay, but then this drop here, that would be the Treasury when it needs to borrow more money. It just issues a whole pile of new T-bills and other things, Treasury notes, Treasury bonds, for the money to finance operations because it runs these massive federal deficits. So you had this big drop here. Prices of them went down because the supply went up because of the auction. Price goes down. And then you'd see this. That was the traders coming back in. 2 weeks later, you'd see that drop. Then that, the traders coming back in. 2 weeks later, the auction. Then that, the traders coming back in. I know this is really new stuff for you, and I'll bet if you took an economics class, you were never taught what I'm teaching you here. Do you see how grim, how dark what's going on there is? You look at the Treasury. You can go and look at Treasury bill prices. You can look at this, and you can see this cyclical wave pattern. What was happening? Yeah? Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you do. Yes. What was going on in the surface? You know what was going on? The Treasury bill prices were skyrocketing. So the Fed was buying the Treasury. That means the Fed was buying the Treasury bills from the banks. But then, and the banks would have all this extra money going to the federal funds market. But then, when the Treasury auction came off, that big supply of Treasuries, new Treasuries coming into the market from the government, would drive the price down. So you know what the banks were doing? They were using the money they made from the last desk purchases to go back to the auction and buy cheap Treasuries again and then wait for the traders to come in and buy them at higher prices. And so every time there was an auction, the prices would drop, the banks would come back in, use the money from their last run to buy Treasury bills, and wait for the traders to come back from the Fed desk and buy them at higher prices again. It was a rolling engine. Essentially, it was like the money was almost not really getting into the economy because it was like a cyclical thing. The government could just keep borrowing money because the Fed was printing money. The banks were holding that money until the next auction when they could lend it to the government by buying government treasury securities. And then you'd go back through the cycle again. Over and over, you look at the data, you can look at the price of the Treasury auctions, you can see that cyclical wave pattern. It just kept going on. It's like an engine. The government is essentially financing its debt by having the Fed execute open market operations. The banks profit from each of these runs because the Fed buys their treasuries at high prices, and then the banks use the money to go back to the auctions at the Treasury when the price has collapsed again because the supply has gone up. That was what was going on. That was one of the primary reasons that these quantitative easings, this massive shovel of money into the economy over and over again over the past 2 years, hasn't really made the economy get much better, because essentially it turned into just nothing but an engine for financing government deficits. Now, here's the dark side. Here's another dark side to the story. Why was Greenspan so bitter, so angry at the success of the economy in the 1990s? You see, by the end of the 1990s, and you will read this if you haven't already, I'm going to assign you a series called The Economics of Wreckage. We actually started running budget surpluses. The government actually was able to pay all of its bills, and it had money left over. This wasn't a fluke, as I show in my series, and you will read it. We had been narrowing the federal budget deficits year over year over year through the years of 1993, clear through the year 2000. And by 1999, we were in the black. We were actually, the government was taking in more tax revenues, mostly because of the just awesome stock market, than it was spending on all of its government programs. That would have been a little before you would have known about things like that, but we were talking about awesome stuff, like we can pay off the national debt, you know, the accumulation of all the debts. The last time we'd run surpluses was in Eisenhower's, at the end of Eisenhower's administration. We'd been accumulating national debt ever since then with budget deficits every year. We're talking about, well, we can pay it off. We can secure Social Security for the rest, as far as we could imagine, Medicare. We can talk about all kinds of very extremely cool programs, as long as we don't lose control of ourselves. We can have money in reserve in case there's ever a bad recession. Just like the original Keynesians had said, you build surpluses during good times, and then you don't have to worry about the bad times because you've got a bunch of money put away. We talked about that. Now, yeah, we actually had, we got it. And then we got to 2001. There was no recession, but the political culture in Washington was obsessed with tax cuts, so they said there was a terrible recession coming, or it had started. Alan Greenspan got on board and said, oh yeah, bad. Historically, even the government's own data showed there was no recession. There was a slowdown in the economy, no recession. But they cut the taxes, and the budget deficits returned. They got worse and worse, and now we're in $1 trillion budget deficit. Why in the world would the Fed, the chairman of the Fed, have essentially, with all the data he has, knowing full well there wasn't a recession, why would he have encouraged the kind of tax cuts the largest and longest in U.S. history? Why would he have gone on board that knowing very well that that would wipe out the surpluses and we would plunge into massive deficits? Why would he have done that? Because the government borrows money by selling treasury securities, treasury bonds, treasury notes, and treasury bills. What does the Federal Open Market Committee use to conduct monetary policy? What does it use? Dollars and what? What happens if the government no longer needs to issue treasury bills? The government issues treasury bills because it needs to borrow money because it doesn't have enough money. But if the government is running budget surpluses, it doesn't issue treasury bills. And therefore, the single most powerful lever, the only one that's actually effective over the economy, the open market operations, they would be shut down because the instrument that the Fed uses, the treasury bills, would no longer exist. In fact, they didn't. There's a period of time at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century when no treasury securities directly, there were some agency stuff going on, but no direct treasury securities were coming out. And therefore, the Federal Reserve had lost its really only effective, powerful tool that would control the American economy. That's why the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, was willing to say what wasn't so, that we were in a recession, we needed massive tax cuts that essentially drove us into a huge budget deficit year over year, with the initiation of two separate theater wars and all the other things that happened in that time period. That's the dark side of the story here. On the bright side, here's the other side of it. Look at this massive pool of money. What's the growth rate of the American economy right now? Do you know? Actually, it's around 1, maybe 1.5%. I'm going to give it in there. The government just came out with its numbers. They'll revise. I'm betting in the range, realistically, a real growth rate of the American economy of 1 to 1.5%. For the past two, almost 3 years now, the Federal Reserve has been flooding the federal funds market with one quantitative easing after another, huge amounts of money pouring into the market. Okay? Just huge amounts of money pouring into the market, into the federal funds market. I want you to tell me if you heard me say this, if you remember what I said. What is the result of a growth rate of the money supply in excess of the real growth rate of the economy? What is the eventual result of that? Go. Inflation. Again, inflation cannot be created by raising the wages of minimum wage workers or union contracts going up. Inflation cannot be created by a business that raises the prices on its stuff. A business cannot, an economy cannot experience an inflation unless there is too much money chasing too few goods. That's just the reality of it. Look, you're a business person. You can raise your prices all you want. That's not going to create inflation. If every business in the United States decided all at once, we're going to raise our prices, people are just going to buy less, unless someone has put extra dollars in their pocket, essentially monetized a price shock. You raise the minimum wage, all that's going to happen is that companies are going to hire fewer workers. They're going to switch to substitute factors of production. It will not create inflation unless money has somehow been created, printed, and put into their pockets. That's the only way that you can create inflation. It's when you print more money than the economy needs for its operations. Keep that in mind. For the rest of your lives, you need to get it tattooed on your ass. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.